Hello. We are here today to discuss the research project run by the Lewis Research Center for European Analysis and Policy, together with the Center for European Policy, and funded by the Italian Ministry for Foreign Affairs. The project focuses on nearshoring and reshorting in emerging markets, comparative analysis of Asia, Latin America, and Africa. And here with us today are Filippo Bontadini from Lewis University and André Wolf from the Center for European Policy to discuss the project's main findings. I would like to start by setting the scene, following the analysis carried out by the Lewis team. Based on your research, what are the main trends of GVC integration that Europe and other emerging economies have experienced?
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm really happy to be here discussing the results of this interesting project that we carried out with the Lewis Center for European Analysis and Policy and our colleagues at the CEP. And that's been generously funded by the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Obviously, I should mention that the views that we express here are ours and not the ministry's, naturally. That goes without saying, but it's worth reminding everyone. And so to answer your question, the research project has really given us the opportunity to delve into the trends in GVC integration, both in Europe and in other emerging economies. And what really transpires is a shift that has happened in terms of trade, with Asia emerging as the main leader or as the region that has grown the most. And in particular, China has really soared in terms of its engagement and participation in global value chains. So we will see that the relationship between Asia and Europe has really strengthened. And that's really the kind of key takeaway at the macro level, and then I'm sure we'll be able to talk more about the more granular findings also together with André.
I see. And what is the role of China as an emerging economic power in the Asian and Pacific region?
Yeah, so exactly. So that's one of the main findings really that we have, is that China has really become one of the leaders, both as a global supplier, global and regional supplier, I should say, and also interestingly as a buyer. So it's not just that China has integrated global value chains by supplying inputs to the rest of the world, but it has also become one of the main sources of demand. And so it draws value added as much as it supplies it to the rest of the region and the globe more generally. So it's really become a hub on both sides of economic transactions.
Certainly. What are the main clusters in terms of GVC participation that emerge in Asia and Europe?
Yes, exactly. So China obviously acts as a center of gravity, so to speak, within the linkages, the input-output linkages and the supply linkages that we find in the Asian and Pacific region. But at the same time, other clusters have emerged. So Vietnam, for example, as an emerging economy, has really taken up a much bigger role in the past few years. We've seen it becoming more important, both in terms of the amount of value added that it supplies, but also as a hub in terms of the frequency with which value added flows through Vietnam as a country. And then it's interesting also to observe that different clusters emerges, whether we cluster countries based on who they source value added from or whether they send value added to. And so on the sourcing side, we find a very strong integration within the Asian and Pacific region, which to some extent mirrors what's happened also in the European continent. And so you see, for example, that Japan really, especially in the car manufacturing sector, remains one of the main centers of gravity, so to speak, again, of the Asian Pacific region, while China has obviously become much bigger. But also you see clusters emerging around Hong Kong and Singapore on the selling side, so to speak. So if we look at clusters based on who countries sell to, we find instead a less fragmented but more asymmetric, so to speak, situation where China really emerges as the main leader of one of the largest cluster that emerges here. And in contrast, most other countries tend to cluster around their own borders. So each country seems to be doing its own thing, so to speak. But you really have this somewhat more homogeneous but integrated version of GVC linkages on the sourcing side, and then instead you have this kind of more obvious headquarter versus factory kind of relationships, with China acting as the main funnel for value added going out of the region.
I understand. And how has Europe's relationship with other emerging economies evolved in terms of GVC integration?
Yeah, so within this, against this backdrop, I would say, of this shift in terms of gravity moving towards the Asian and Pacific region, and to some extent away from European countries, we can see, however, that Europe has been on a double pathway in a way that, on the one hand, it has integrated more with itself, so among European countries, but also the relationship with the Asian economy has also strengthened as a result, of course. So we see that Asia and Europe exchange significantly more value added than in the past. And at the same time, what is interesting is also that Europe also engages more, for example, with the African continent and to some extent the Latin American region as well, compared to Asia. Asia seems to be much more on a pathway towards regional integration with these clusters that emerge that I've just discussed a few minutes ago, while Europe seems to be engaging both with the Asian economy, which obviously has grown much more in size, and that obviously means that it's become a much more important partner from an economic point of view, but also African economies in particular seem to be playing a significant role. They've increased significantly the amount of value add that they supply to Europe, although obviously as a African economies remain relatively small, economically speaking, but they have grown significantly. What is interesting from our research is also that we are able to make the distinction between the amount of value added that a country supplies to another country, but also we can also measure its importance as a supplier in terms of the frequency with which production processes go through a certain country. So to give an idea, for example, if we want to know that a certain, say, a German car to be manufactured, it will source a certain amount of value added, say, from Morocco, and we can see how much that is. But we can also see, on average, how many times the production chain that culminates in the production of German car goes through Morocco, and that is a measure that we call, based on the contribution in the literature from other co-authors, from other authors, the pass-through frequency. And so if we make this distinction between how strategic a supplier is in terms of how many times value added flows through them versus how much value added it flows through them, we can see that the connection between these two measures for Asia has really been positive. So Asia has become an important supplier for European countries on both these scores, while for Africa, what we find is that value added has increased, but the number, the frequency with which European economies and African economies interact with each other, so to speak, really hasn't moved that much. And that to some extent reflects the fact that African economies tend to be specialized in upstream sectors, which therefore are less strategic in terms of how much of a hub they act as within the global production processes. But at the same time, that also gives avenues for improvement. And so that obviously calls for an increased effort in terms of fostering this relationship between Europe and Africa in a way that allows Africa to engage in structural change towards more manufacturing intensive specialization, and it really kind of avoids a sort of exploitative relationship between the European continent just drawing resources in specific natural resources away from African countries that also are exposed to price volatilities and have a lot of difficulties that go with that. And so the main takeaway from a policy perspective is really that Africa has the potential to engage more with European economies, and vice versa, European economies have a potential to draw more benefits from Africa, also in the perspective of diversifying the sources of input that the European economy has. But that demands, requires really a development process between that is fostered with Europe and Africa, so that African economies can also move along the value chains.
Many thanks for that interesting insight. Let me now turn to André Wolf from CEP. Before delving into the insights from your research, perhaps you might like to introduce the Center for European Policy and how the collaboration with the Lewis Research Center for European Analysis and Policy came about.
Yeah, hello. Thanks a lot for having me. I'm representing the Center for European Policy, as you said. And we are basically conducting all kinds of European policy analysis devoted both to an evaluation of recent proposals by the European Commission regarding new regulations, new directives, but also own ex-ante analysis of new policy proposals, own new policy strategies. And in this project here with Lewis, our part was focused on the policy side of trade. We first investigated patterns of past trade relations with different regions of the world. We also highlighted the role trade policies and trade agreements have played in this respect. And finally, we also derived some policy recommendations on how to improve future economic cooperation of Europe with these other world regions in order to boost European economic growth and contribute to the long-term targets, the long-term policy targets of the EU.
Excellent. In the current situation, why is a strategic realignment of EU trade policies necessary?
Well, currently, the EU is facing a lot of challenges, both from the inside and from the outside. From the inside, there's, of course, the big long-term challenge of transforming our economy towards a decarbonized and digitalized industry across all sectors we could think of. And this, of course, requires many things. We need to restructure our supply chains. We need new kinds of resources, both mineral resources and renewable energies. And we also need new kinds of sales markets in order to make sure that our green products can be sold worldwide, that enough revenue comes in to refinance the huge investments the transformation requires. Therefore, it's very important for the EU to gain new partners. On the outside, of course, there's this whole process of geoeconomic fragmentation we can witness nowadays in global trade, with China as the rising power, as Filippo already mentioned, with an increasingly unpredictable US trade policy, and a lot of other emerging economies trying to gain more strategic weight in overall trade. And in this new area, in this new sphere, the EU needs to gain new partners to diversify its current trade routes, to reduce dependencies, and thereby also reduce trade risks to its own transformation.
Right. And what is the role of new strategic partnerships in implementing such a shift?
We think that deepened strategic partnerships with certain third countries can be quite valuable for the EU's overall trade policy strategy. Those partnerships go beyond classical trade agreement in the sense that they do not simply lift existing trade barriers, but also foresee increased cooperation in areas like knowledge exchange, joint R&D facilities, training of workers in the countries participating, work on joint standards, and also increased engagement and regulatory convergence. In the end, with a prime goal to build common markets, to scale our new technologies, and make sure that the EU, together with its partners, can increase its strategic weight in the future world.
More specifically, what is it that makes Africa such an attractive partner during Europe's green transformation?
For many reasons, we believe that Africa could become one of the keys in the EU's transformation strategy. One reason is, as Filippo already mentioned, the huge growth potential of the African economies, especially when it comes to workforce. The work population in Africa is predicted to double until 2050. It will make up about 85% of overall world labor growth. That's pretty significant already. And then there's, of course, also the huge potential in terms of tangible resources, like critical minerals. Of course, first we think about cobalt from Congo, but there's a lot of more interesting mineral resources for Europe to tap into. For instance, tantalum, also platinum from South Africa. So a huge variety of minerals that are critical for all the green technologies we need to decarbonize our industry. And then there's, of course, also the huge issue of energy security for Europe, especially since the beginning of the Ukraine war and the raging energy crisis. And there we believe that there is really a business model for renewable hydrogen from Africa, especially from the northern part of Africa, countries like Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, which on the one hand exhibit significant potential in terms of PV and wind power, but on the other hand also exhibit the crucial advantage that they are very close to Europe. They already have gas pipelines through the Mediterranean Sea in place, so they can avoid the costly transport of hydrogen per ship, and thereby are in a very good position to supply very cost-efficient hydrogen to Europe in quite a short amount of time. And finally, there's also the increasing problem of the skill gap Europe is about to face in the near future, especially in fields like engineering, natural sciences, or electrical engineering in particular. And in this regard, we believe that Africa, with its growing workforce, can make a very valuable contribution if we, for instance, invest in training in those countries, engage in knowledge exchange and skill cooperation to make sure that we do not run out of skill supply. And then finally, we should also talk about the growing role of China in Africa, increased partnerships, especially with some African countries, could be very valuable to contain this influence, to make sure that China does not further spread its own political influence in sub-Saharan Africa, and thereby make sure that the European voice remains heard.
That's fascinating. And what are the main obstacles that need to be addressed in economic cooperation with Africa?
Well, one crucial obstacle is still the quite significant infrastructure deficit in many African regions. When we talk about renewable energies, for instance, it's the problem of grid access to electricity grids. The current grid infrastructure is still very patchy in Africa. Peripheral areas do not have consistent access to the grids. And for these, of course, a lot of greenfield investments are necessary. And this can create something like chicken and egg problems, because if you need to invest in infrastructure and production capacities like PV, wind power plants at the same time, the problem is always to answer the question, what comes first? And if the infrastructure waits for production and vice versa, nothing will happen. So a lot of policy impulses and clear signals are needed to overcome such deficits in infrastructure building. And then there's, of course, the increasing problem of indebtedness of African countries towards countries like China, but also towards many Western countries, which limits their scope for public investments in their own infrastructure and further increases the risk that they are subject to more and more political influence by China, which is increasing its own lending power towards African countries quite significantly and is continuing to do so in the years to come. And then there's finally, of course, the high degree of general political instability and regulatory uncertainty in many African countries, which significantly raises the financing costs from the perspective of investors, especially for investors from Europe, which need to factor in these risks in calculating the returns to their investments, which basically implies that discount rates for the investments will be so high that even investments which could create quite significant revenues are still not bankable. So in sum, there is definitely a case to make for increased policy intervention from the European side in order to absorb these risks, at least partly, to coordinate infrastructure investment efforts, and finally also to reduce these risks in the long term through increased regulatory cooperation with African countries, through increased peace diplomacy, not only trade diplomacy, and through own means to reduce these risks for European importers, like, for instance, hydrogen purchase programs or market platforms to share the risks among the diverse private traders in Europe.
Finally, what are the key components of an EU-African cooperation strategy?
As I just already said, I think one key component is definitely regulatory cooperation. We need to convince African leaders that regulatory stability is key for investments to take place, especially for private investments. And we also need to indicate that, of course, political stability in its widest sense has a very high value also for private investors, which, of course, also implies that there is increased initiative to invest in political accountability in Africa, in rule of law, also in democracy, which will not be, of course, achieved in the short term in many countries, that's for sure. But at least African leaders need to know that they need to make steps in this direction in order to attract private capital. And then there's, of course, also further the need to engage in public-private partnerships to speed up infrastructure development in many African countries, also to increase something like a level playing field among African countries. Many countries currently are already engaging in a future African free trade zone. I think that's a very good step towards economic integration in Africa. But of course, this also requires a lot of policy coordination, not only regarding terrorists, but also regarding market rules, regarding product standards and so on. And in this respect, I think it's very important that also Europe makes clear that continuous engagement, not only in tariff reductions, but also in deeper, more product-specific market regulation cooperation is essential for economic growth to happen, especially also for restructuring of the African economy towards more high-value-added manufacturing.
Well, thank you very much to you both for sharing these interesting findings of this research project by the Lewis Research Center for European Analysis and Policy and CEP. I really look forward to getting into the details of this work in the working paper and policy briefs that the project has produced. Many thanks.